devil's advocates. Never personal, only politics.
And we're back for our final half an hour this beautiful Tuesday afternoon here in the Devil's Advocates Radio Show. My name is Jim Santel. Evan is my producer this afternoon. We are taking your phone calls at 844-967-2789. We're chatting all day today about the J6 Committee, the results of its two and a half hour presentation today. It comes in the wake of another story that hit out of the Washington Post and some other media late last week that also puts in context everything that we chatted about earlier, this ellipse presentation, this ellipse speech that the president gave, what happened at the Capitol moments after that. Washington Post reporting that there were, among the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys, huge numbers of weapons present with them at that time. We know well that the president, President Trump at that time, specifically asked that the people attending the ellipse assembly there, the rally there, not be subjected to reviews and searches because he knew that they had weapons. He was told they had weapons. Additional reporting these days that there were staged weapons beyond just the ellipse in the suburbs around Washington, D.C. There was military ordnance. There were grenades in the area. A huge amount of potentially even more horrific violence could have happened. Undeniably, a group, including the Proud Boys, including the Oath Keepers, heavily armed. We know that about 120 people or so have already been charged with weapons violations in connection with January 6th. Again, puts in context the seriousness of what was intended, including that of the President of the United States of America. And the J6 Committee, again, beginning to draw what Jamie Raskin and Stephanie Murphy, the principal presenters today, Jamie Raskin, Congressman from Maryland, Stephanie Murphy, a congresswoman from Florida, described as this convergence of efforts that brought together the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers and many others on January 6th on the ellipse at the Capitol itself for the riot there. And all the work not in a positive way designed to get that group, that crowd, that mob there in the first place. A lot of focus, again, upon this meeting of December 18th that resulted in the president inviting groups of people to come to Washington, D.C. on January 6th, encouraging them, as he would ultimately say, to fight like hell, presumably on his behalf. We know at the end of the proceedings today, we also heard from two witnesses who testified about their specific involvement, and one of them with the Oath Keepers and Stuart Rhodes, Jason Tatenhoff, who was for a while one of the principal media folks, was allied with Stuart Rhodes. Stuart Rhodes, as Tatenhoff indicated this afternoon, was a resident in his basement for a while. Tatenhoff today recognizing that his longstanding affiliation with Stuart Rhodes and the Oath Keepers was not only unwise, but plainly very dangerous, and ultimately said, I've got to distance myself from this group. Today, what did he say? He said, they are a militia. They're a very dangerous organization, and talked about the fact that this was an attempt to put together an armed revolution. This is from somebody, again, used to be affiliated with the Oath Keepers. He talked about the fact that there was this gallows set up on the Capitol Hill itself, presumably for the vice president or some other people there who had run afoul of the interests of the Oath Keepers and others there. And significantly said, what I saw there that day, this is coming from Jason Tatenhoff, could have been the spark to another civil war. That is his testimony today in front of the J6 committee. And then, as I said in the prior segment, this singular individual, Jason Ayers, there with his wife, probably being a representative person of so many who were there the day, who talked about being duped. Misled, deceived into coming to Washington, D.C. by a president who he trusted. When the president said to him, you know what, the election has been stolen, it has been taken away, Jason Ayers believed his president and believed what he was reading on social media, believed what he was seeing on Facebook, and said, I needed to be there because my president told me to be there. Described it as the worst mistake of his life, losing his job, his home, plainly having an impact upon his family. How many other Stephen Ayers are out there in the context of people who came to Washington, D.C., lives now forever affected, if not ruined, as we know as well. People died there that day. People dramatically impacted physically as well, psychologically, emotionally. The impact of what happened that day cannot be overstated. Dick, you're also on the phone this afternoon. We welcome your comments or your questions.
Well, to that last story, too bad, so sad. I hate to be so callous, but here I look at stuff, James, totally different than most people. For instance, this whole January 6th thing, what was going on in the same timeline they always bring up? COVID. And you know how they like to say, oh, the former president was responsible for warp speed? No, he wasn't. But we'll get by that. And even if he was, what kind of a leader or a president would have done what he was doing to just stay in power when thousands of people were still dying of COVID? And we all know now that when he left office, only about 3 or 4% of people were vaccinated, when in fact the vaccination was out there late in his presidency. I guess my question to you is, you know, guys, you people that are just such sycophants and that can't get over the fact that he lost, he still had a job to do. And Absolutely. His job became nothing more than self-preservation and to stay in freaking office.
Right.
As opposed to doing what you should do as a president.
No, Dick, I couldn't agree more. We talked earlier today about the notion that you take an oath in office, right? You take an oath in office to support the Constitution, to execute the laws, a duty of care to the American people. That's what your point is all about. Everything we heard about today and previous times, it's all about staying in power. It's not about serving the people of the United States of America. You know, Dick, when you speak about COVID-19 and what the president knew here, I think there are also some parallels here. Your point is very well taken. We know because of Bob Woodward's book, the very same time that this president, this former president, was telling us that this was not that big a deal, that we're not, don't need to be all that focused upon this, and plainly minimizing the significance of a virus that took the lives of more than 1 million people in the end, and 300 people continue to die to this day from this virus. We know from Bob Woodward that the same time that this president was saying those things publicly, minimizing the impact of this, telling people that they can in fact do things that they should not do, further spread the virus, we know that the president understood just the opposite, right? Because he told Bob Woodward that. We know that from the tapes. He tells Bob Woodward, Bob, this is a serious thing. It's a big deal. People are going to die. And turns around and says just the opposite to the American population. I would offer, Dick, following up on your very good comment here, that we have the same thing here. We've got a president who plainly knows. He has been told by everybody from his counsel to his own children, to people surrounding him, to everyone. But the Rudy Giulianis and the Mike Flynns and the Sidney Powells of the world that he did not in fact win this election. He knows that. He understands that. He is not a stupid human being. He is a deceptive. And what does he do? He goes out and he tells America that in fact the election was in fact stolen. And that I would offer to you is the ultimate in violation of your oath to work on behalf of the people of America, the people who put you in that office in the first place. It does not go to a criminal exposure, but it certainly, again, puts all of this in historical perspective. When our grandchildren think about this presidency, all of these kinds of things, COVID-19, Dick, as you say, the circumstances under which a lot of this happened, all of them have to be read together in terms of an administration that was not at the top, focused on what's best for America. We've got another caller, Gary, calling in. We're delighted to have you with us. Gary, okay, we're going to take Gary perhaps later on in the course of the program, but appreciate again all of your phone calls as they come in here on a regular basis. We're heading into the last portions of our discussion today about the J6 committee. We know at the very end of the committee, in addition to this testimony from Jason Tatenhoff and Stephen Ayers, that there was this very personal testimony about the impact of what happened on January 6th on them. This armed revolution, as Tatenhoff described it, this potential spark to a new civil war. Plainly, those things presented by this committee almost as victim impact statements. I think about many of these things in the context of what a trial would look like. The Stephen Ayers of the world, who, again, if you did not see him this afternoon, pick up that testimony and watch as he stands, he sits there in front of his own wife, and they plainly are not just somber, they're devastated by the fact that they were misled by a president of the United States of America to do something that compromised their lives. That's the impact of this in the individual way on families in America. That's the impact upon hundreds of people indicted, charged, many of them sentenced already, many of them still under investigation, under prosecution. That is the impact of what he did, what this former president did to Americans, and, as I've said before, his impact upon our psyche generally, further perpetuating this notion that there was, in fact, a steal. We see that to this day in the state of Wisconsin. The news that we just heard about continuing candidates advocating for election reform when, in fact, there is nothing about the past, nothing about the present that suggests that we have got an elective process, we've got a polling process where massive fraud happens on a regular basis. 60 or more judges found exactly that sort of thing, the same kinds of things that happened out there across the country, findings by judges basically repelling, rejecting the notion that the big lie is real, rejecting the very thing that Donald Trump was in fact advocating for and continues to advocate for to this very day. And so as we begin to move to the end of our time together, I wanted to focus on a couple things. One of them, again, Liz Cheney, always bringing to a conclusion here with a little nugget of something that's very, very interesting, plainly discussing what's going to happen next. We had heard initially that the committee was going to have a prime time presentation this coming Thursday. They have decided not to do that, so you can watch something else on Thursday evening. But at some point down the road, there will be an eighth hearing and maybe more hearings, and again, anticipating a report from this committee at some point in the late summer, early fall. But at the end of this, of today's hearing, Liz Cheney, as she always does, gives us a little bit of a nugget of something to think about. We were called from the Cassidy Hutchinson testimony of last week that she described her the context that she had from people, presumably on behalf of the president, saying, you know what, we anticipate you're doing the right thing. We know that people will be listening to you. And she regarded that appropriately as intimidation, witness tampering. In a broader sense, that's obstruction of justice. Today, Liz Cheney, the vice chair of this committee, returned to that in the very last minutes of the committee hearing. Some of you need to watch for it at the very, very end. Not a lot of exposition here, but Liz Cheney once again saying, you know what, we've got other evidence of witness tampering with respect to witnesses coming before this very committee. And it's nice to talk about witness tampering and say, well, gosh, you know, you're threatening them, you're doing those kinds of things, and that's horrific. There's a larger understanding of that. That is a crime. That is a crime. You can't do that. And just like you need to show up for a testimonial appearance when you're subpoenaed to do so, likewise, you cannot intimidate witnesses. You can't suggest to them that bad things will happen or that people are watching you. And we are tantalized by the fact that Liz Cheney said at the end of the hearing today that there is more evidence that the committee has that witnesses who are appearing before this very committee are being tampered with, and that the very process of justice, which is the exposition of the truth before this committee, presumably also being pursued by the Department of Justice, that all those kinds of things might be affected by those people out there who don't want the truth to come forward, who are doing this witness tampering, who are engaging in obstruction of justice. That is a violation of the law. It is a violation of Section 7217 of Title 26 of the United States Code. I know, Evan, you know that well. It prohibits,
yes.
You have that at your fingertips, right?
Yeah.
Prohibits anybody from the executive branch or anyone in a position of responsibility from influencing or in any way affecting the testimony they may give. Obstruction of justice, those kinds of things cannot be had under our federal criminal code. We'll talk about more about that. And a final story that brings us out of the Devil's Advocates radio show this afternoon. Come back after the break. We're talking more about the J6 committee and related events in the United States of America.
stop this thing.